It's tragic for the international order that the evidence compelled us to move in relation to a head of government of a country like the Russian Federation that is a permanent member of the Security Council. The head of government has had a warrant issued against him for war crimes. It brings me no joy. It really makes me very sad.
I'm speaking to Karim Khan, prosecutor at the International Criminal Court since 2021. We need to address Ukraine. You've described it as a crime scene. The crimes are widespread and extensive, so you don't have infinite resources. So how do you focus the ICC's efforts the best you can in Ukraine?
Well, you make decisions, and the decisions must be informed by many factors, gravity, availability of evidence, and the need to work at the speed of relevance. So exactly this is what we've done in relation to Ukraine, in relation to the public warrants, because of the admissions effectively made by individuals in the Russian Federation, particularly President Putin and Madame Lvova-Belova. We investigated crimes against children and we move forward. And that's the basic approach anywhere else. We look at the most serious crimes. We see, you know, when there's more than one serious crime, we'll also look at the types of evidence available and start moving, I think, and then we can go deeper if and when necessary and if and when justified by the evidence.
And you're supporting prosecutions occurring in Ukraine where they can?
We're working in partnership. We're independent and, of course, impartial, but we're working with Ukraine. We're helping them with a forensic rotational model that is under the flag of my office and the ICC, in which we're giving them technical support. We have other experts in there, but they're also helping us in terms of providing information, and we're scrutinising it to make sure it's accurate, reliable and truthful. And moving forward together, for the first time, I'm part of a joint investigative team with many countries under the rubric of Eurojust in The Hague. We're doing it not just in Ukraine, we've done the same in Libya with the United Kingdom, the Netherlands, Spain, Italy, Europol, in terms of human trafficking. And that's already led to three arrests at least of human trafficking. And those individuals are being prosecuted in the courts of Italy and Netherlands. And we've given evidence that has led to those arrests. So it's really realizing at this moment we need to build partnerships, and it doesn't matter which flag is behind the judge. Is it the ICC flag or a national flag? What we need to do is to really show that we're more than talk collectively at the national level, and at the international level, we can feel justice.
You've mentioned the arrest warrant against Russian President Vladimir Putin. I just want to get a bit of clarity on that. What's the significance of it? Is it symbolic? Is it a statement of intent? It seems unlikely we'll see him in a court.
It's not symbolic, it's tragic. It's tragic from every vantage point. It's tragic for the parents, the grandparents, the families of those that are taken away. It's tragic for Ukraine as a country. It's tragic for the children who are learning a language that is not their own, or in a country that is not their own and in institutions that are not their own. It's tragic for the international order that the evidence compelled us to move in relation to a head of government of a country like the Russian Federation that has great history, that played such an important role in the end, you know, in the Second World War against National Socialism, that is a permanent member of the Security Council, and that a country of such history of art and music and literature, their head of government has had a warrant issued against him for war crimes. It brings me no joy. It really makes me very sad. But states have decisions to make. Do they want to pursue a course in which they disregard international law? Or do they realise that compliance with the law, notwithstanding the imperfect application of the law previously in other situations, but the application of the law with more fidelity is in their own national interest of their country? And I think you know, these events challenge leaders. What do they put first? Individual interest, political aspirations, dogma, ideology, or the interests of humanity and their own people? But what I would look at is there are other historic situations that were intractable. Hissam Habre was head of government. Charles Taylor was head of government. Milosevic was head of government. And people thought, what a ludicrous, you know, jumped up court it is that indicted, had the audacity to indict former President Milosevic or Charles Taylor. How could a court with no police arrest these people who were heads of government with armies, and yet history shows those individuals saw the inside of a courtroom and were subjected to appearance before independent judges, and there were trials and processes. And for example, Charles Taylor, former prisoner Charles Taylor, was convicted and is in prison.
So you don't rule it out for Putin?
I'm sorry?
So you don't rule it out for Putin?
Time is a wonderful thing. I don't know what will happen next minute without knowing what will happen, you know, in a month or a year or a decade. So we do what we can do based upon principle and evidence, and then time creates opportunities or not.
Events of the 7th of October and subsequently have put the Middle East back very much at the top of the agenda for everyone, very much a focus. The ICC was already investigating possible war crimes and crimes against humanity dating back to 2014, perpetrated by Israeli armed forces, Hamas, and other Palestinian groups. So what have recent events changed for the ICC?
Well, the jurisdiction remains, of course. Mm-hmm. The jurisdiction also has been rendered even clearer that in relation to missile attacks from Palestine into Israel that may constitute violations of the Rome Statute in terms of intentionally targeting civilians, we've added to the issue of state nationals, you know, nationals or state parties committing crimes on the territory of Israel. So if that's proved, we have jurisdiction in relation to the 7th of October. But we see the devastation in Gaza at the moment. We see the spike, an upsurge in settler violence by Israeli settlers against Palestinians in the West Bank. We see misery on all sides. We've got to make sure that the law is seen to be not an optional extra. The court is as strong or as weak as the cooperation that we get. But I think there are imaginative ways across all our situations in which the office is trying to move forward, realizing the difficulties that we're in. But also, hopefully, it becomes a bit starker to states that we can't continue in this direction of not giving sufficient regard to human life, because hate begets hate, and hate begets violence, and violence causes instability, insecurity, and even wider conflicts. That's what history tells us. And so we need to learn those lessons of history and act accordingly and change course from the direction which I think we are traveling internationally, which is towards more conflagrations and more suffering in Israel, Palestine, Ukraine, Myanmar, Afghanistan, and the list goes on. But the malady seems to be the same. It's an idea that you can grab what you can get. Hate can trump restraint. And that leads to a world where there are these multiple epicenters of conflict in which the most vulnerable, the weakest, the most innocent pay the price on the altar of, you know, ideologies.
You've used the phrase speed of relevance repeatedly. Perhaps you can just fill that out, just to be specific on what you mean by that.
Well, international justice isn't only a normative value. It's not only an inalienable right of individuals. It's not only a function of the international principle that there's no statute of limitations for war crimes. I think there has to be a more acute realization that when people are in terror and fearing for their lives, the law has to be seen to be relevant to them. It can't be this approach that we take a decade. We can't create evidence. We have to collect evidence. We have to make sure it's relevant or authentic. But it's an effort not to impose an arbitrary timelines, but to have enough purpose that and a sophisticated enough strategy to make sure that we are increasingly relevant. And we see it in states, we see it in individuals. Very often, the position can be inertia. That can be the default position. And states sometimes may not move to the discomfort of change because it's discomfort. But they may do so if it is put in stark contrast to pain. And very often the ICC, dealing with individual criminal responsibility, is an important tool to focus minds to make sure that states have every opportunity to close the door to us. But to close the door to the ICC jurisdiction where we have it, it requires states to step up. And I've said, if states step up, I'll step out. It's not a favor. It's one of the foundational principles. So states are masters of their own destiny by complying with the law and properly investigating, you know, crimes. And that's something I want to foster, and realizing that we also need to build relationships. ICC is not a court of supervisory jurisdiction. We also need to be more willing to be a hub in which we can build our own cases when states are unwilling or unable. But we can also provide evidence and information to national authorities, not only of situation countries, but of other countries that are willing to exercise universal jurisdiction or to try to join us in the quest of eradicating impunity and ensuring justice. And I think that creates a more healthy and sustainable dynamic in which we also are more clearly relevant to national authorities.
The ICC has been in existence for a little over 20 years, and we've spoken to your predecessors about the challenges they faced establishing the court early on. It'd be great to get your view on progress of the court and the challenges facing you at the moment.
International justice is a work in progress. It's far from perfect, but it has latent potential. And I think before I was elected, there was an excellent report that Justice Richard Goldstone, who of course is well known to the IBA, he chaired, along with many other experts from all over the world, that identified areas of weakness and of concern to improve the operation of international justice, not only in my office, but in the judiciary, in the registry, and elsewhere. And we've reorganized the office. We've made a lot of changes internally. We are trying to focus more on delivery in terms of being closer to the field, trying to work at the speed of relevance. So we've already put forward a policy paper on gender persecution. That's already finding form in some of our investigations. Announced new policies on gender crimes, new policies on children, crimes against and affecting children. And we've launched a new consultation paper on cooperation and complementarity. But I think the key issue are not the policy papers as pieces of art to put on bookshelves. It is the link or the imperative to make sure those policies apply in practice. And I think that's the area that we've made some progress. But of course, much more work to be done.
You've got serious situations, Ukraine, Sudan, Palestine, elsewhere. Your resources are spread thinly. Are they spread too thinly to meet the obligations laid down in the Rome Statute?
I think it's extremely difficult. I think the office has spread itself too thin over a number of years. I think I have to find a way to deal with what I've inherited in a principled manner. But I've also said, even before I was elected, my vision of the ICC that is sustainable is we have a narrower number of situations but go deeper. If you look at it from a resource perspective, you know, the amount of effort, time, money to have the language skills, the analytical skills of a particular country is quite immense. And if you only do two or three cases and then move on, it's not really sufficient, I think, to move the dial of accountability in a discernible manner. Whereas if one goes deep and does 30 cases or 20 cases or 10 cases, maybe you can extract the poison from, you know, help the national authorities or do it yourself, extract the poison of hate or criminal responsibility that can allow a country to get back together in terms of reconciliation for the sake of argument, and that requires justice. So that's going to be something we have to do over some years, but at the moment I still have to deal with what I've inherited effectively, and I think the challenges for states. I've also, for the first time, used the provision of the Rome Statute of voluntary contributions, not earmarked to any situation. That's had some success, but there's a primary responsibility on the Assembly of State Parties to properly fund the court that they've created. And so far, I think they could do much better.
There has historically been an anti-ICC sentiment, I suppose is a fair description, across the continent of Africa from African states. Is that an issue of concern for you still?
Well, I've been delighted by the progress. I mean, I was the first prosecutor in 17 years invited to the African Union Heads of State Summit in 2021. I went again this year and I've been invited next year. Mm. I've had multiple meetings with the previous chairs of the commission, Macky Sall and President Tshisekedi, head of the commission, Faki, in Addis. So we're moving forward on multiple lines, both investigations in relation to situations, building complementarity like we have in the Central African Republic. But of course, one can't rest on one's laurels. It can always be better. It can also improve. But that applies to the WEOG group, the Western European and other group. It applies to the Asia group and the GRULAC group. So we need to keep building, forging new bonds. But I think we do that by engagement, by listening and being, you know, trying to ensure international justice is relevant to the states and to the regions of the world.
You've spoken about the need for the ICC to be nimble and effective. How are you going about achieving that?
We're doing it by realizing that from every perspective, including working at the speed of relevance, we have to be closer to the countries we're working in. Mm-hmm. So field officers we have now in Kyiv, we have a presence in Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh regarding the Rohingya, opening offices in Bogota and in Caracas. I've given instructions. I don't want to have any team or situation without nationals from the countries concerned, a realization that nobody knows the country better than people living in it and people from the region. And if we listen more and embrace those that diversity of legal system and that specialized knowledge of the country, we're less likely to be taken for the, you know, ignorant tourist abroad and more likely to have a more accurate compass that will help us build proper cases that will stand up to scrutiny in the courtroom.